Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. In a rare public rebuke, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints condemns Tim Ballard's morally unacceptable behavior. A doctor with ties to anti-LGBTQ hate groups is now serving on Utah's Trans Sports Commission, and hundreds of new affordable homes will be built in seven Utah cities. Joining me today for the program are Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Real estate reporter Tony Semerat is with us. Thanks for joining us.
You bet.
And news columnist Robert Gerke is with us. Thanks, Robert.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Robert, I want to start with you. I'll have you talk about this this whole Tim Ballard case. This is quite the deal. I guess maybe to preface this, well, let me just have you remind listeners who Tim Ballard is and why he's well known.
Right. I think Tim Ballard's star has really risen in the last year or so. But for about 10 years, he founded this group called Operation Underground Railroad. And its intent is to conduct operations around the globe to rescue victims of child sex trafficking. Over time, he's become a real cause celeb in the particularly in the conservative world. The Operation Underground Railroad's fundraising has gone through the roof, and more recently in July they released this movie based loosely on his life events called Sound of Freedom. He's been met with, he went out to Mar-a-Lago, screened the film with Donald Trump, has had Donald Trump on his podcast. The Sound of Freedom, Operation Underground Railroad itself has become criticized over the years for becoming a little QAnon adjacent and for some of the tactics it uses in these operations. The theory being that they're out creating a demand for sex trafficking of children, rather than necessarily fighting it, and also just sort of the self-aggrandizement and the attention seeking that they've engaged in over the years has rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But Tim himself has become very prominent, especially as I mentioned, in the conservative world.
And it looks like he was, and maybe still is, gearing up for a run for the Senate.
Yeah, he's, Sean Reyes in particular kind of teased the notion that Sean Reyes opted out of running for the Senate race, the attorney general, and he teased the idea that a close friend of his and a patriot will be entering the race. Tim has sort of confirmed, well, he has confirmed that he is considering it. And would be a formidable candidate if he gets in, just because we know his name recognition, the respect, I guess, that many people on the right have for him, and his ability to raise a lot of money.
So let's get to the church's statement. I guess to preface this by saying that Tim Ballard apparently had a friendship with M. Russell Ballard. No relation, I guess. So tell us who M. Russell Ballard is.
Yeah, this is going to get complicated, isn't it? M. Russell Ballard is the acting president of the Quorum of the Twelve for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a very high-ranking and influential leader in the faith. And Tim Ballard developed this friendship with him over the years, according to the statement that came out from the church. It was a mutual desire to help kids all around the globe. But Tim would, and I, it's been reported, this was reported in Vice, and I've been told similar things by sources who are, former associates of Operation Underground Railroad, that Tim would often use Russell Ballard's name to sort of lend credibility to the organization and the operations that they were doing. Where things kind of got sideways between the two of them was when, according to the Vice article, Tim Ballard started using Russell Ballard's name in some business ventures he was doing, suggesting that Russell Ballard was a partner in them, or at least a supporter of the organization that he was trying to start. And that seemed to really irritate, I guess, President Ballard, and led apparently to the statement that was issued late last week.
What did the statement say?
Well, so yeah, it was a really scathing rebuke, I think, especially from a, you know, an organization that doesn't typically single people out and castigate them publicly like this. I'll read part of it here. It says, once it became clear that Tim Ballard had betrayed their friendship through the unauthorized use of President Ballard's name for Tim Ballard's personal advantage and activity regarded as morally unacceptable, President Ballard withdrew his association. President Ballard never authorized his name or the name of the church to be used for Tim's personal or financial interests. And that morally unacceptable phrase caught a lot of attention. I mean, that's a really strong indictment from the church toward a member of the faith. I mean, Tim's a very prominent, outspoken member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so for the church to, you know, publicly castigate him like that, was a real blow. And I think, you know, if we want to think about politics, I guess in this case, a real setback for any potential Senate campaign, but also just a personal rebuke that based on Tim's reactions to it since then, really stung.
Where do we think that phrase come from? You can understand the phrase in the statement about you know, using the name of President Ballard. He didn't like that, but morally unacceptable behavior. Where's that come from?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. They haven't really elaborated on what that morally unacceptable behavior was, based on the context where they talk about the unauthorized use of his name for financial gain and personal advantage. You know, there is, as I mentioned, the suggestion that Tim was dropping President Ballard's name to promote his business interests. It's also been reported in Vice that Tim has been accused of sexual misconduct by women who worked with OUR or went on these operations with him, posing as his wife. And you know, Tim, you know, the theory being that he was trying to convince these women that they needed to sell the role that they were playing of his wife, and he took liberties with that is what the Vice article reports. Tim has denied those allegations, but you know, as in July, or I'm sorry, in June, Tim left OUR. According to the Vice article, he was forced out. Tim says it was a departure that had long been anticipated. Either way, you know, that also could be what we're talking about when we hear the term morally unacceptable. Regardless, I think it's a stinging phrase that has kind of caught people's attention. And as I mentioned before, highly unusual for the church to issue a statement condemning an individual, particularly an individual who, by most accounts, I think was in good standing with the faith.
So that's one of Tim Ballard's arguments against this. He is saying, I believe, that he does not believe the church issued this statement.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about Tim's reaction to it. His initial reaction was he was in Boston for an event and was speaking to some supporters and said he doesn't believe the church issued this statement. He thinks that maybe he questions why it would have been given to, why they would have said this to Vice News, which he doesn't consider a credible news source. But to be clear, though, Vice stands behind the reporting on this, and they based it on a trove of documents that they received from an investigation that was conducted into Operation Underground Railroad's fundraising tactics. An investigation, by the way, that was closed without charges being filed. I should note that. But Tim's raising...
Let's see, I don't know if we've lost Robert there. Are you with us? Let's see, we seem to have lost Robert there. You're back. We lost you there for a minute, Robert. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I don't know how much you missed, but Yeah, he said he considers President Ballard to be sort of a grandfather figure, and he doesn't believe that the church would have done it this way. And so he's raising some real questions about it. And that doubt that he's trying to sow, I think, has really caught on among his supporters. You know, we've been hearing from people who are questioning why the church did it this way, because the statement itself was not attributed to a spokesman by name. It was sort of not anonymous. It was a statement from the church. But, you know, there's a pretty, we have confirmed that it is the authenticity of the statement. It did indeed come from the church public relations department. And when the church issues statements like this, it's not just the public relations department that does it. I mean, there is a process that they go through to have these vetted, but because when it comes from the public relations department, it is speaking on behalf of the faith, and so it carries a lot of clout. So anyway, but Tim's argument, yeah, is that they don't really believe that the statement would have been handled this way, and they question whether it is authentic, which it by all accounts is.
And so he's denying the report. He's denying that he doesn't believe the church issued the statement. And he's denying any allegations of sexual misconduct. What about the relationship, the accusation of trading on a relationship with President Ballard?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, I've talked to some people who were formerly affiliated with OUR, and they said that Tim would frequently bring up President Ballard's name, talk about blessings that he had been given by the president. You know, they would go on operations, and he would talk about how he had met with President Ballard. So that was part of it. But, you know, again, President Ballard acknowledged that they had a mutual desire to help children. And so maybe that's not so exceptional. As I mentioned before, the Vice News article specifically references a for-profit business that Tim was trying to gin up support for. And he suggested that President Ballard was supportive of it and possibly a partner in the business, which would have been a pretty significant assertion, and one that, according to this statement, you know, he did not have permission to do. And taking a step back, I mean, there's this whole network, or this whole philosophy, criminal philosophy, I guess, called affinity fraud. And affinity fraud hinges on, you know, playing on people's allegiances to a faith or to a belief, and you know, exploiting that for financial gain. And so the suggestion would then be that by using Russell Ballard's name in an unauthorized manner for profit, that, you know, there's a potential there that there's some affinity fraud that's gone on.
Governor Cox weighed in on this. In fact, he says he reached out to the church personally. I was assured the statement did come from the church. That's one thing Governor Cox said. What else did he say?
Yeah, yesterday Governor Cox had a news conference, and it kind of goes, I think, to all of these questions that were swirling around the authenticity of the statement, you know. But he said the allegations against Tim Ballard are, quote, incredibly disturbing to him, and called them unconscionable. You know, so those are also pretty strong words coming from the governor, on top of the morally unacceptable phrase that the church used. So not a good week for Tim Ballard.
So you, in your column, you talk about this. One statement really stood out to me. You kind of do a self-examination of the media. I'll just quote this. The Utah news media, myself included, have been so enamored with the notion that Tim Ballard's out there rescuing kids that we barely tugged on the loose threads of the narrative he's built up around himself.
Yeah. This is sort of owning, I think, our own failures. I think we don't like it when national outlets like Vice have to come in and report stuff in our own backyard. And we had heard rumblings about these things for a number of years, but we've never really dug into them the way that I think. And when I say we, it's all across the news media. Fox News has done some reporting on it. We've done a little bit of reporting on it, but not to the extent that evidently we should have. And so, you know, it's been I don't know if I'd call it a failing on our part, but because we to be fair to the news media, we have a lot of other things that we're covering as well. So, but I think there was obviously a lot more there that we should have spent a little bit more time looking at. And there were holes in the stories that Tim Ballard was telling. I mean, we talked before on this show about seeming inconsistencies, definite inconsistencies in the story he told about how he got into this field, and exaggerations that were made in the film based on his life. So there's more to come. I think there are obviously are other shoes that are yet to drop. And now I think we're fully engaged on it. So hopefully we, as the news media writ large in the state, do a better job on this.
In the meantime, Senate campaign seems to be, Tim Ballard released a video, compared himself to Abraham Lincoln, says he's not going to quit. I guess we presume that includes the Senate run. We don't know yet, I guess.
We don't know yet, but there's no indication that he's going to back down on this. And again, I think he would remain a front running contender, you know, or a top tier contender if he does get into the race, just because, as I mentioned, his ability to raise money and his name recognition and his supporters are, you know, his political base would very much be that of the Trump wing of the party, which is already shown itself to be not have a problem with sexual misconduct and not have a problem with stretching the truth or lying, and to really, you know, feel like the media assassination game, or to, you know, they paint both Trump and Ballard as martyrs in this of the media. So I don't know that it necessarily would be a fatal blow to have the church call him morally unacceptable, because people in this day and age, politics is more important to many people than it is than their religion is.
Well, thanks, Robert, for your reporting this, telling us about this. And we should mention that the various reporters, many stories here in the Salt Lake Tribune, Brian Schott and Peggy Fitcher-Stack and Jenna Reese and Robert Gerke as well. Let's go to a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. When we come back, the headline is: a doctor with ties to anti-LGBTQ hate groups now serving on Utah's Trans Sports Commission. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So we want to talk about this story. The headline is: a doctor with ties to anti-LGBTQ hate groups is now serving on Utah's Trans Sports Commission. Maybe let's start there. Maybe even before that, there was a bill passed, right, by the legislature, which I think would, well, tell us what that bill would have done. I think it's under injunction. And I think this commission is a backup plan, right?
That's exactly right. So HB 11, which was highly watched in 2022, was passed. Conservative lawmakers pushed it through kind of over Governor Spencer Cox's veto. And the point of the bill was to ban transgender girls from playing on girls' high school sports teams here in the state. That was enjoined by a judge, and so it's not in effect right now. The ban is not in effect right now while a lawsuit is going through the court against the ban. This commission is, like you said, it's kind of a backup plan that's also written in the bill that is kind of triggered. The bill was written so that if the outright ban on transgender girls was held up by the courts, that this commission would move forward instead.
Who is on the commission? What types of people?
Right. So the commission is 7 members, and they're each appointed by a political leader. Well, 6 of the 7 are appointed by a political leader. They have different kind of titles written into the bill. So there's, you know, a physician, there's someone who is a representative of the High School Activities Association, there's someone who kind of works with college athletes, there's a a psychologist, there's a statistician, you know, there's kind of all of these specific positions that are meant to be filled by experts.
And I understand various people, Speaker Wilson appoints some, Senate President Stuart Adams appoints some, I think the governor as well. So this gentleman in question, Dr., how do you pronounce his name?
It's Ruse, so just pretend like the H doesn't exist.
Okay, Paul Ruse. He was appointed by Speaker Wilson. What role is he supposed to fill on the commission?
So his spot is literally for a board-certified physician with expertise in gender identity healthcare. That's what the law says. And yeah, House Speaker Brad Wilson kind of has the sole discretion to appoint the person to fill that board-certified physician spot.
So tell us about Dr. Ruse.
Yeah, it's probably hard to capture in a few words, but he has kind of made a name for himself in court cases, siding with conservative states that are trying to enforce, you know, anti-transgender laws. So he's been kind of an expert in different areas in North Carolina and Arkansas, speaking against essentially gender affirming care for transgender people. But his views are pretty controversial. I mean, every major medical association in the country is opposed to where Paul Ruse is aligned. So he essentially is against gender affirming care. He has called being transgender a social contagion. He has said he intentionally won't treat transgender patients. All of his publications are in religious outlets. You know, he doesn't shy away from saying, you know, that he's a Catholic physician and that he supports, you know, the Catholic Church's positions on transgender care. So he's definitely aligned on one side of the topic, I guess we can say.
I was interested to learn in your story, Courtney, that he's an endocrinologist. He specializes in diabetes. He doesn't. He purposely does not take cases of gender dysphoria, right? But many endocrinologists I'm reading do treat gender dysphoria because they work with hormones.
Exactly. Yeah. Endocrinology is, it's based on hormones. So it kind of makes sense that a lot of those doctors and those specialists do work on, you know, gender affirming care and making sure that their patients have access to, like, you know, the hormones they need or the puberty blockers they need. But yeah, Paul Ruse has specialized in diabetes, which obviously is another path in endocrinology, but he has specifically said that he won't work with transgender patients.
In the meantime, he does get called as a witness in court cases, I guess. Tell us about that. And that some judges have attacked his bona fides, I guess.
Right. So he has kind of become part of this team of, you know, conservative doctors that have been willing to testify against gender affirming care. And all of the judges in the cases that I could see had at least partially disqualified Ruse as an expert, saying that he, you know, was speaking from like a personal position and not as an expert, you know, because he hadn't worked with transgender patients. He hadn't published peer-reviewed journals. You know, he's just this very controversial pick. One judge called him conspiratorial. Another said he was deeply biased. So he has kind of tried to make a name for himself in these court cases and has been paid to do so, but is very often kind of ruled out as a witness.
Apparently, Dr. Ruse promotes a method he calls watchful waiting. What is that?
Yeah, this is a controversial method. So Dr. Ruse believes that most kids who are transgender, if you just kind of leave them alone, that they'll return back to the sex they were assigned at birth. That is not what peer-reviewed studies say. And the doctor who actually came up with the concept of watchful waiting said it was only helpful in prepubescent kids. But as soon as a kid, you know, kind of got into the other stages of adolescence, you know, became a teenager, if they were still kind of persisting in, you know, in identifying with a different gender, that they should be treated, that they should receive care and be affirmed in the gender that they align with.
Like other in your story, other researchers have said that they're concerned that Dr. Ruse is misusing their research as well.
Yeah. And then, you know, same with the kind of watchful waiting idea. Yeah, he cites these studies, but he often leaves out kind of key information in their work. And so a lot of these researchers have kind of called him out for that. So like part of like the watchful waiting, he suggests that most of these kids will realign with their sex assigned at birth. But the studies that he's basing that on have kind of been largely disqualified. I mean, they've been heavily critiqued, if nothing else, for having kind of distortions of data. And they use a different standard. So they're outdated. So they weren't looking at transgender children, for instance. They were looking at something that's kind of wider. It's called sex discordant gender identity disorder. So it would count any kid that had any variation in how they perceive their gender. So that would be like girls that are commonly referred to as like tomboys, for instance. And so it kind of made sense that they might not like stay in that identity and would obviously kind of align with the sex they were assigned at birth. And so, you know, those studies themselves are kind of questioned. And then these doctors and these researchers that did the studies are like, look, you're misinterpreting this too. Like, you're making this worse.
Tell us about, you write, one of Dr. Ruse's most controversial connections is Alliance Defending Freedom. Tell me about that group.
Right. So Alliance Defending Freedom is recognized by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. They have advocated for state-sanctioned sterilization of transgender people, mostly in Europe, but they are kind of this controversial anti-LGBT group. And Paul Ruse, has confirmed in two separate court depositions that he attended this conference that the group held in 2017 in Arizona. And the point of that conference was actually to cultivate a list of court witnesses like Dr. Ruse that would be willing to speak against transgender care. And that's not the only hate group that he's been associated with. He went to, you know, a second controversial conference in Spain that was purposely trying to, you know, get rid of LGBTQ friendly laws. He's also with a pediatric group that's considered a hate group. So kind of these associations that he has.
You talked to at least one parent who has non-binary kids who said she already had reservations about a trans sports commission. Now with the selection of Dr. Ruse, she feels certain that this isn't in good faith. I'm putting words in her mouth, but tell me what she said.
Right. I think you captured it well. I think that parents and advocates are worried with this selection that the commission was never intended to be neutral, that the commission is acting in the same way that an outright ban would be when you appoint people like Dr. Ruse, who are kind of adamantly against, you know, transgender care and transgender patients and don't want to recognize, you know, those people for who they are. And so, yeah, this mom who has two non-binary kids, you know, is worried. You know, the commission to her was already this kind of controversial thing that's, you know, these adults are essentially measuring kids' bodies to see whether or not they can play. That's the point of the commission, is to look at transgender girls and determine whether they're going to allow them to compete or not. And so this mom was already worried about that idea. And now she just feels like it's even worse. You know, you have this man on here who's adamantly against transgender kids.
Of course, it would be great to get Speaker Wilson's point of view, but I don't think you were able to get that.
Yeah, and it's kind of a common thread. A lot of state agencies that have a hand in this commission or you know, help set up the bill just like wouldn't respond. But yeah, Speaker Wilson kind of stands out because he selected Dr. Ruse. And yeah, I reached out to his office multiple times to ask questions and just declined to comment. He did release a statement, but it didn't really address his decision at all to appoint Dr. Ruse.
So the commission, I believe it's set up, it's supposed to, you know, if it was a trans girl who wants to participate in sports, then they go before this commission. Has this commission treated any cases at this point?
It's really hard to see, to be honest. So this commission, written into the law, there's a lot of secrecy around it, so it doesn't have to release any of its decisions. All of its decisions on cases are private, and that's partially meant to, you know, protect the privacy of the transgender athlete. But it's really kind of shrouded this commission in a lot of secrecy. And so they are subject to the Utah Open Meetings Law. And so I was able to look up their agendas online, and they have met four times, and it looks like they've talked about a transgender athlete's case four different times, like at each of those meetings, but it's unclear if like multiple athletes were in a meeting or if one athlete's case got like continued to the next meeting. So it's really hard to say how many cases specifically that they've actually like made decisions on, but they have talked about athlete cases.
Courtney, you had a few days ago, you had another story related to this. This has to do with the injunction against the House Bill 11, which would rule out, trans athletes. But the judge ruled against the law, and now that's making its way through the courts. A question about private medical records for transgender minors has come up. Give me your 1 minute version of this story.
Right. So, yeah, this commission is kind of going on one end, but the court case kind of opposing the outright ban is still going. And so the latest ruling in that decision, the state wanted access to the transgender girls who are suing over the ban. They wanted access to their medical records. And this judge granted that access, essentially said the state has a right in this case, and that's central to the case to understand, you know, the medical history and the mental health history of these girls.
And so we'll yet to be seen here what this the appeal will do and what'll happen next with the commission. Thanks, Courtney, for telling us all about this. Robert Gerke, what do you think about these stories?
I mean, I think it's really disgusting the way that they've approached this this commission, because, you know, I kind of share this this parent's views that Courtney mentioned, that this was supposed to be a middle ground and bring expertise to bear, and then to pick somebody who's not an expert or is clearly biased. We wouldn't have a diabetes commission and have somebody on it who thinks we should apply leeches as a cure for this. It's choosing somebody who's so backwards and out of touch with the accepted medical practices is transparently political and transparently trying to achieve the ends that they couldn't achieve through the discriminatory law that they passed, or they haven't been able to achieve it yet. So, you know, it shows what's actually motivating them. It's not the interest of these kids. It's trying to achieve an ends and drive an agenda, the conservative agenda that Brad Wilson wants to, you know, shore up his right wing bona fides so he can run for Mitt Romney's seat. It's and who suffers? I mean, it's the kids who are going to suffer with this kind of backward, hate driven policy. And I think it's really an embarrassment to the legislature, to Speaker Wilson, and to the state.
Let's head toward another break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about this headline: hundreds of new affordable homes will be built in 7 Utah cities. We'll be talking with real estate reporter Tony Semerad. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCBW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. More following this. Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to real estate reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
So a couple of stories here that are very much related, and we had a kind of a big picture look at this last week on the program with you. One headline, hundreds of new affordable homes to be built in 7 Utah cities. The other headline, even with prices dipping, Utah's housing markets remain unaffordable for most residents. First tell us about these affordable homes to be built. Who is doing this?
Well, so this is a couple of Utah-based foundations, one called FJ Management, which is essentially the charitable arm of the company that owns the Maverick and the Come and Go chains of convenience stores. The other is a foundation called Ivory Innovations, which is the extension of Ivory Homes, a nonprofit that's focused on affordable housing and kind of solving that set of problems in the state. They've gotten together through some personal ties between the CEOs for a relatively big foray into affordable housing construction. They envision building upwards of, on this first go round anyway, upwards of 850 rent subsidized dwellings. These would be in the range of 80% to 60% of the adjusted median income. That's the rent subsidy. There's a site at the Liberty Wells gym donated by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Salt Lake City, as well as South Jordan, Draper, Magna, Lehigh, I believe Francis and Park City. These are going to be a range of developments involving apartments and townhomes, which will all be kept affordable thanks to the largesse of this of these two foundations that are calling this project Housing for Impact. And it's very interesting what's motivating them. Of course, Ivory Innovations has been in the affordable housing space since, I believe, 2017. Is kind of an idea generator, if you will, for ways of addressing affordable housing. FJ Management's got kind of a different angle on it with their acquisition, I believe, last year of the Come and Go chain, or earlier this year of the Come and Go chain. They're up to about 13,000 convenience store employees between Maverick and Come and Go. And their CEO expressed an interest in kind of meeting those employees' needs. Those hourly wage workers, according to surveys, are really suffering with regard to finding affordable housing. And so that's what's motivating FJ Management, is they kind of want to get into this space on behalf of their employees and others. Over the course, this is a first phase on these projects in seven cities, and they're hoping to keep this rolling. It could add up to really thousands of units over the course of the next decade or so. It always, some of these projects that of affordable housings with their unit numbers seem sort of incremental, and it doesn't seem like we really get anywhere with regard to addressing the affordable housing crisis. But these are some impressive numbers, and the estimate is it could be thousands of units by the time they're done.
You mentioned this. It really struck me, the person at FJ Management. They did a survey of their hourly employees, and came back and said the major challenges are food and housing. That really struck them. They kept raising their wages, but still, employees are still having trouble with meeting food and housing.
Yeah, well, that foundation Call to Action had initially gotten into education, and they've offered a number of scholarships at higher education institutions in the state. And their CEO, Crystal Magalette, said that they initiated the survey with employees initially with the idea of extending tutoring services to some of those families. And they were sort of struck that there was very little interest in these tutoring services. And it turned out with these sort of follow-up surveys of up to 3,000 or so of their employees that, food and housing were much higher priorities. Came as a bit of a jolt, according to Crystal Magalette, and they sort of reshaped their foundation to focus on housing. They've gotten into the preservation space in, I believe, one other state where they've bought units that were going to be demolished, affordable units, and they're sort of renovating those and keeping those on the market. And they have plans to make similar purchases in Utah in addition to this Housing for Impact project.
Yeah, good news. Maybe transition into the other story here, but with a quote from the first story. Governor Cox, in celebration of this announcement, he said, I'm quoting this from your story, "When 77% of your state can't afford the price of housing today, we know that something has gone wrong." And he says we need to increase the supply. So, and then as we learned from you last week, and you've quoted again in this next story, houses, apartments, condominiums, townhouses have never been less affordable at least in the last 50 years. We are in a crunch right now.
Yeah, this announcement is, a glimmer of positivity, if you will, in the face of a lot of bad news on the affordable housing front that's come out in the last couple of months. As we talked about last week, we've had this report from the Gardner Policy Institute that houses and apartments have never been less affordable in a 50-year history in the state. And this ratio of incomes to what people need to spend on housing has never been more skewed. Governor Cox said he gets asked about housing, or he gets asked about what keeps him up at night again and again, and he always says it's housing prices. They've just gotten incredibly skewed, and this sort of 10-year real estate boom that we've been on has been sort of summarily snuffed out by these rises in interest rates. It's just a growing concern.
You quote Dave Anderton, a spokesperson for Salt Lake Board of Realtors. His quote, "We've cut out a lot of first-time buyers." Cut out. That's pretty stark. Also, move-up buyers getting frozen out of the market.
Yeah. If you look at the decline in home sales on a county basis, Wasatch Front-wide, and even statewide, that decline in light of the raise of interest rates actually represents, a kind of a class of would-be home buyers, which is essentially first-time home buyers. Those are the ones that are getting shut out. Starting to affect the move-up buyer also, but it's most definitely decimated the first-time buyers' opportunities to purchase homes. And you know, there are surveys that indicate that group overlaps with other marginalized groups. So when first-time buyers are being excluded from the market, that typically means lower-income families. That means people of color. That means, you know, single-parent households, that sort of thing. And so, not only first-time buyers, but some of the economically disadvantaged people that might buy homes in this market are also being cut out.
So the solution is more housing, more homes, more apartments for rent. Is that what's needed?
Well, that has generally been the policy tenor, you know, for the last 3 or 4 years, that we need to increase supply. There is an increasing sort of conviction that the private sector simply cannot take care of this problem. And this was emphasized at the Housing for Impact announcement on Tuesday, the shift seems to be now these kind of public-private partnerships where foundations are involved or there are collaborations with cities that involve financial incentives. So supply does seem to be the focus, but actually building more affordable units remains a very deep challenge.
And in the meantime, I think we covered this, we mentioned this last week, but it bears repeating. Surveys indicate that a growing number of renters believe they'll never be able to purchase a home. So that gets us into psychology and sociology and ills of our society right now.
Yeah, surveys indicate 9 out of 10 people have that, renters have that sentiment. And if you look at the actual hard dollars of it, that 77% ratio that Governor Cox referred to bears out. We've seen data that indicates that most people that own homes in along the Wasatch Front now probably couldn't afford their own home if they were forced to buy it in this current market. The ratio of incomes to the median home price has never been more skewed. I think it was at about six times the median income would be needed to buy the median priced home in this market, which a number that has escalated dramatically in the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, thanks, Tony, for telling us about these stories.
Yeah, lots of bad news, but
but hopefully a glimmer of hope here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Robert Gerke, what do you think about this, especially this, new affordable homes to be built?
Yeah, it's encouraging. We've talked a lot on here in the past about how important this is to the, trying to solve this problem. I think it's encouraging to see these home builders step up because they've made an awful lot of money off of this surging housing market. And so it's nice to see them give some of it back and help people who have been, who've fallen through the cracks or are unable to participate in that in the housing market. Hopefully it makes an impact. As Tony mentioned, it's kind of incremental in some ways, but it takes those increments to get to where we're trying to get to. Hopefully we see more of it, and hopefully we see some real effort from the legislature to step up and fill the void too. I mean, they're ultimately, as much as the private sector wants to step in and help out, it's going to take some involvement from the legislature and from our governments to really get our hands around this.
Well, Robert, before we get to underplayed stories of the week, I was intrigued by your latest column. Give me the 1 minute version of this. A Utah group is putting UFO docs online.
Yeah, I just thought this one was kind of interesting, kind of quirky. There's a group based in Salt Lake who this woman has been a UFO investigator for many years, has been active in the you know, sort of this UFO culture, and has collected, she said, 140,000 documents related to UFO sightings and investigations. And they're in the process of putting these online and making them available to researchers all over the globe. There are a few of these similar projects scattered around the world. But the idea is, you know, let's get the best information we can and then make it available in a way that, you know, is not necessarily, say, controlled by the government or whatever else might be, whatever concerns might be there. Just make it all available for people to see. And so they've started doing that. There's a number of them up there, and I flipped through it last week when they first launched it. And, you know, there's some interesting stuff there.
Very interesting. You find that at sltrib.com. Well, it's time now for Underplayed Stories of the Week. Let's go first to Courtney Tanner. What's your Underplayed Story of the Week, Courtney?
Yeah, I'm going to pick a story from Sophia Jeremias, who did this really good look, along with, I should say, Rick Egan, our photographer, too. This look at city workers fencing around this popular area where a lot of the homeless folks in Salt Lake City had been staying. And there's a lot of people that are upset now that this huge area that had like benches and lights is now essentially off limits.
Yeah, you can find that at sltrib.com. Yeah, that's a great story. Tony Simrad, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, mine comes from colleague Leah Larson, who has just done absolutely stellar coverage of the Great Salt Lake. This one, a little bleak, is about these frequent dust storms that we're seeing in the valley as a result of the desiccated lakes. Exposed beds, only 10% of which have been covered by this recent spurt of water. And she takes a look at what that dust is doing to our bodies in the air. And, you know, there are maybe 12 to 15 of these events now each year, an increasing concern.
That's a great story as well, sltrib.com. I would note that she had a whole package of stories in the Great Salt Lake this week, so sltrib.com for all those stories. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week?
This one maybe isn't underplayed, but it's an important one. Courtney broke news this morning that the report from the Federal Department of Education, or was it Department of Justice, Courtney? Said that Alpine School District failed to investigate at least 100 reports of sexual misconduct, sexual assault in the school. In some cases, just ignored them completely, it sounds like, let teachers resign quietly. And, you know, it's pretty infuriating that the district would neglect to care for the kids who are, you know, supposed to be watching out for. And, you know, if I was a parent of one of these students, I'd be on the warpath. Somebody needs to get fired over this. Let's put it that way.
Courtney, anything briefly you'd like to say on that? That's out just today.
Yeah, I think Robert captured it really well. It's a pretty damning report. Went through pages and pages last night, and it's worth reading. Pretty horrifying instances, particularly with students that were trying to report their teachers for assault.
That's out just today by Courtney Tanner. You can find that at sltrib.com. My underplayed story of the week, Peyton Harkin's story. Very interesting story, kind of illustrative of some problems statewide. She wrote a story about Tooele County. The headline, Utah's fastest growing county empties out most mornings. Leaders are trying to change that. And then talks about water availability, increased traffic, loss of small town feel are all concerns that Tooele County officials are trying to deal with. You can find that from Peyton Harkins at sltrib.com. Well, we appreciate everybody being on with us today. We have been talking with reporter Courtney Tanner, with real estate reporter Tony Semerad, with news columnist Robert Gerke, and our thanks to all of you for joining us. And you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. Hope you'll join me next time.